to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show.
We're continuing our look at the book, The Mind of the CEO by Jeffrey E. Garton. Last show, we were looking at the section True North and Other Virtues. And we were talking about the company Motorola, which was one of the big players in cell phones in the 1990s. In 1998, Galvin and his colleagues turned Motorola on its head. Costs were slashed by $750 million, and 20,000 of the firm's 150,000 jobs were eliminated. The company was reorganized primarily around two businesses. Most important, the so-called Warring Tribes, the small innovative fiefdoms that had grown up and competed with one another, gave way to a restructured company with emphasis on teamwork and on common technology. The compensation system was changed to reward employees for collaboration, whereas the emphasis had been on innovation for its own sake. Now employees were evaluated in how well they could find out what the customer wanted and deliver the products and services that were in demand. The most fundamental thing we had to do from a senior leadership standpoint was to reassess the orthodoxies and dogmas of the company. Galvin told me, "We discovered that the more incredibly complex the technology is, the more people want it simplified. We changed everything but our principles." Motorola made a 180-degree change. It moved from an incubator for individual entrepreneurs, what Galvin calls a personality-based organization, that fostered complex technologies and gave short shift to consumer preference, to exactly the opposite. Namely, a collaborative and simplified internal culture that keyed directly onto customers. It was surely the right move, but how does a leader maintain true north amid such a radical change? And how will all the company's constituencies see it? Another case is Goldman Sachs. Henry Paulson said he's open to any kind of change at his firm so long as the core values remain in place. For him, this included the traditions of teamwork and the goal of serving only premier clients in well-defined areas. But consider some of the changes that have swept over this investment bank in just the last 2 years. Goldman Sachs went from being a privately held partnership to a publicly listed company with thousands of shareholders. In the process, it became subject to the scrutiny of the markets and the media as never before. Overnight, its top executives, generally known only in the industry, became public figures. Their net worth and financial independence soared. Responding to stock market pressures and to shareholder expectations, the firm began a major expansion. In 1999 alone, it announced plans to add 3,000 staff, roughly a 20% increase in personnel. An effort to find new talent from universities in foreign countries like China was announced as well. Once a company that promoted almost entirely from within, eschewing the normal Wall Street practice of lateral hires, it began to bring in investment banking stars from rival firms like Lazard, Frère, Merrill Lynch, Salmon Smith Barney, and Morgan Stanley, Dean Witter. In late August 2000, there were even rumors on Wall Street that the firm, in contrast to its traditional focus on institutions and extremely wealthy individuals, was moving into brokering and trading for smaller retail clients, capitalizing on the growing importance of individual investors to the U.S. economy. Many more changes can be expected as the financial services industry continues to see bigger mergers and more activities around the world. Witness the combinations of Citibank and Travelers Insurance, Credit Suisse, First Boston, Donaldson, Lufkin and Jenrette, or J.P. Morgan and Chase Manhattan, all quite recently. In early September 2000, Goldman Sachs was hot on the path of further expansion as well, announcing its plan to acquire Speer, Leeds, and Kellogg, the biggest matcher of buyers and sellers on the floor of American stock exchanges. No doubt Goldman Sachs will try to maintain its culture, for its leadership is obsessed with doing so. But to the extent that culture is dependent on who owns a firm, who controls it, who works it, and who its customers are, and how big it is, Paulson and his team face a Herculean challenge in maintaining the values that they cherish. As traditional companies embrace the internet economy, more and more structural and cultural change would be involved beyond mergers, restructurings, and alliances. Investment banker Nancy Peretzman and Allen & Company talks about the need for CEOs to break some glass when it comes to their traditional constituent relationships. She is referring to the changes that are occurring as producers of information and products deal directly with their customers rather than through layers of middlemen. When music can be downloaded directly from the internet, what happens to outlets like Tower Records? And what point do CEOs of entertainment companies disrupt long-standing ties with such retail distributors? Auto companies like General Motors have flirted with selling cars directly to customers. What happens to the historic relationship between Detroit and the dealerships? Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and others have been customers of the New York Stock Exchange, but they are also helping to set up competing electronic stock exchanges in which they will have substantial business interests. Peretzman says that those CEOs who are not thinking about how to position themselves vis-a-vis some of their traditional business relationships are going to have big problems down the road. True North is both an invaluable concept and a difficult one to implement. Founder CEOs, men like Richard Branson, Michael Dell, Frederick Smith, Michael Bloomberg, Rupert Murdoch, Stan Sheeh, have an easier time demonstrating it in their organizations. After all, it comes directly from them. And because founders remain at the helm of their companies much longer than the typical chief executive, they have more time to input their values and philosophy throughout the corporation. What happens when they depart is another story. For them, as well as other executives, the requirement remains the same: to identify what they stand for in more than platitudes, communicate it, and stick by it, all the while exhibiting extreme adaptability to rapidly changing circumstances. How many people can rise to this standard? Part of True North is being seen as trustworthy. CEOs talk frequently about the critical importance of trust in an organization. But in the middle of this new industrial revolution, with all the uncertainties, surprises, and market pressures, what does being trusted really mean? Michael Armstrong emphasizes that employees have to believe that their company's top management has the interests of the rank and file at heart, and that what the company is doing and how it's changing is actually good for them. If people are going to follow your vision and take the risk of changing their habits and their practice, they must know that they can trust that the institution will not only reward them for their success, but that it will not be punished unduly for taking risks that don't pan out. He told me Armstrong's ability to make good on what he knows is essential will now be surely tested as he tries to manage the break of AT&T. Rolf Breuer of Deutsche Bank agrees with this. Quote, a leader must get people aligned to follow him, he said. Employees have to be convinced that what you are doing is leading to the right kind of development for the firm. They have to feel that they are in safe hands, that the firm's leader is really caring for the prospects of the institution, and by extension, for each of them. Like Armstrong, Breuer faces its own challenges in enacting the theories of his bank, which is undergoing radical transformation from a stodgy European commercial bank to a top-level global investment bank. While trust has always been an important anchor to any CEO, its value is heightened today. In the old economy, rigid bureaucracies prescribed what people did and how they did it, leaving little room for creative judgment. Most companies operated in self-contained units and within their home countries. The pace of change was slow, and large-scale restructurings were not commonplace. All this is different now. Employees work in flexible teams with fewer guidelines than they once had. Companies are more dependent on outsourcing and partnerships, and virtual organizations are becoming increasingly the norm. Executing deals requires a high level of cooperation among employees resident in different countries, and every great company is in the continuous state of organizational change. The ethos of trust between leaders and their colleagues and employees and among workers themselves is the glue that holds everything together in the new economy. Without a CEO who is trusted and who imparts the quality of trust, a company is in great jeopardy. Trust, however, is not a simple concept. It involves qualities that might be called hard and soft. A leader gains trust by getting results, by setting corporate targets and achieving them, by creating value for shareholders, by running a company profitable enough to create good jobs and good wages, and by having the resources and willingness to contribute to the communities in which the company operates. Trust also entails creating an organizational structure that makes decisions openly and fairly. The development of a company's strategy must be seen as deliberate and thoughtful, with promotions and compensation based on objective criteria that everyone understands. Some of these goals ought to be achieved easily, but some require more nuanced approaches that marry a leader's need to be decisive with the importance of being as fair as possible under high pressure. The environment surrounding the internet will give you the feeling that everyone is equal in the company. Lawrence Weinbach, Unisys chairman and CEO, says, quote, but we have nearly 40,000 people here and not everyone is equal. Sometimes you have to be an autocrat. When something is very crucial to the company and you feel very, very strongly about it, you cannot allow it to be put up to consensus. There are many other times, most of the time, in fact, when you as a group have to hash out an issue and come to a decision. But you better be clear if you do put an issue before a group and ask them to come up with an answer. You will be willing to accept it. A leader has to pick which issues go where, and he has to be upfront about it. One quality necessary to engender trust is a leader's willingness to be transparent, to explain to all of a company's constituents what is happening and why it is happening. John Brown says that when people are getting real information, as opposed to being informed by rumor or simply executive assertion, they are more apt to think that their leaders are being straight with them. I do think that information is ubiquitous. It goes everywhere, he said. And I think that the meaning of that is actually that there are very few secrets, and therefore you may as well be transparent. But it is a good thing to do as well, because transparency creates trust. Trust also requires integrity. CEOs who say one thing and do another, those who blame others for their own faulty decisions, or leaders who ask the troops to tighten their belts while they pursue more elaborate corporate jets, obviously arouse suspicion among all their employees. Alternately, an executive's integrity is enhanced when he or she takes responsibility for a mistake or a wrong position on ethical issues. Important as trust is, there are several reasons why many employees feel insecure or even betrayed today. In order to achieve their financial goals and to meet Wall Street's expectations, many CEOs have had to preside over a variety of corporate restructurings that have resulted in tens of thousands of people losing their jobs. When Michael Armstrong took the reins of AT&T in 1997, he set a reduction target of 18,000 employees. Jürgen Schrempf of Daimler Chrysler, Richard Thoman of Xerox, Christopher Calvin of Motorola all made compatible cutbacks in their workforces. Such actions not only affect those with pink slips, but create anxieties among their colleagues who do remain employed.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you're listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
When you come in an atmosphere of peace and working together in solidarity, there's no problem whatsoever of Israelis and Palestinians living together.
In the past 2 years, more than 3,000 Palestinian families have lost their homes to make way for Israeli settlements, roads, and walls. Working side by side, teams of Israelis and Palestinians are together rebuilding demolished homes and courageously building a bridge to peace.
One has to be optimistic, otherwise there's no reason for being here. If we can't help a little bit and translate that optimism into a little bit of action, then we're defeated. And all of us here refuse to be defeated.
You can help. To support the Rebuilding Homes campaign, visit rebuildinghomes.org or call 415-820-3204.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at the book, The Mind of the CEO, which in many ways looks at the future of the corporation, by Jeffrey E. Garten. We were looking at chapter True North and Other Virtues, and we're looking at some wedges that exist between top business leaders and their employees. Another wedge between top business leaders and their employees is the impact of globalization on job security. The liberalization of trade has already resulted in the transfer of substantial manufacturing activity from the industrialized to the developing world. The pressure on jobs in the United States, Europe, and Japan has already expanded beyond manufacturing into the service sector, and now even to technology and engineering, as evident in the growth of high technology regions in India, Singapore, and Taiwan. If there hasn't been a loud outcry, it's because unemployment is low, but more job transfers are in store. and come the next recession, it will bite much harder. Also, how can employees bank on the commitments of their leaders when the same executives may not be around for long? CEOs are in increasingly tenuous positions, their survival dependent on stock market performance, which itself is highly volatile. In addition, the job market for top corporate leaders has rarely been more active, particularly with the lure of stock options from technology companies. And many top executives are often tempted and likely to move to more lucrative positions. Here, the question of outside CEO compensation practices is relevant. CEOs who perform extremely well are worth the fortune that they take home to all of the company's constituencies. But if top executives arrive with guarantees of enormous severance packages, even if they do not succeed in creating value for the company, they are not sharing the risk with employees who have no such floor underneath them. In recent years, the rewards for even failure have become almost legendary. Jill Barad presided over a disaster at Mattel, yet took home $50 million. Doug Ivester lasted less than two tumultuous years at Coca-Cola and won a severance packages of $25.5 million. Dirk Jaeger was ousted at Procter & Gamble after 17 months as CEO and took home close to $10 million. This doesn't make for much trust. PepsiCo's Roger Enrico was the only American CEO who broached the compensation subject. We were talking about income inequalities on a global basis, and Enrico made a point about the importance of the middle class to business and the dangers of extreme income disparities. He was more confident about the problem than the solution, but he was seized by the issue nevertheless. In the past, he said, quote, "Business is not a very good steward of the broader marketplace, but what you do, what can you do about that?" I asked him how he saw things in the future. Quote, "I don't know," he answered. "I don't think the signs are very good. I don't have a prescription, so maybe there aren't any good answers. But I would say to you that just one example would suggest to me that not many people are thinking about this. And that's the disparity between CEO compensation and the company's employees. Now, maybe a lot of that is driven by the stock market and stock options, but I don't see a lot of discipline in that." He then related a story. When Don Kendall was CEO of this company, he took great pride in a chart in Fortune magazine which measured performance and pay. And they put the faces of the CEOs in the chart. And Kendall was proud because he was in the high percentage performance group and also in the low pay category. I mean, that really made him feel good. And he had more than enough money to live on. It wasn't like he was starving to death, unquote. I had read that Enrico himself donated his entire salary to scholarships for employees, retaining only bonuses for performance. And I asked him to explain this. Quote, "I'm not making a statement to the outside world. The outside world can do what it wants," he said. "I'm not trying to impress people. I just felt I needed to do something." Trust goes well beyond the relationship between leaders and the people they work with. In today's business climate, trust between a company and its employees are equally critical. Thus, of course, is why brand reputation is so important and valuable. A company may be constantly restructuring. It may be experimenting with new products and new ways to get closer to its customers. But if the brand denotes reliability throughout all the changes, in good times and bad, that will be an overwhelming competitive advantage over time. The same considerations apply to the links between a company and its suppliers as well. Among the most interesting thoughts I've heard from CEOs on these subjects come from Jack Welch and John Brown, who took slightly different angles on the topic of trust. Welch talked to me about how the internet will transform relationships. It's going to change the relationship with every constituent. Your customer is going to have a different relationship with you. Your supplier is going to have a different relationship, he said, they're going to be much more permanent because you're both going to be more dependent on one another. He went on to say that the enthusiasm for creating new markets for producers to buy supplies is an internet, such as an internet auction, would work only if a company was looking to buy undifferentiated commodities. But it will not work for sophisticated supply chain stuff, because if the supplier is really doing a good job for us, we'd better be smart enough to stay with that supplier. He'll grow, he'll become more productive. We'll pass on the productivity gains and better prices to our customer. And that's altogether different. I asked him whether he was advocating a way of doing business based more on trust between a company and its suppliers. He agreed, but he qualified that the trust was based on, it's not about trusting a person, he said, but the whole operation, the integrity of the process. Because of the internet, you have the data. You can see through what you want. You know where things are in their shops. John Brown told me another story that embodies one of the ways that he looks at trust. Although he never used the word, it illustrates his thinking about how a global company should behave. One of the most important changes in the business world that I've experienced is in the way big companies exercise power, he said. I always remember my predecessor, David Simon, who always used to talk in sporting metaphors. He used to say, when he took over in 1992, BP was on a light middleweight in the ring with heavyweights, and he had to learn to understand how to conserve BP's punches, to use its speed, to come around, and at least gain some advantages from time to time with the heavyweights. We now punch with the strength of a heavyweight. And if you inadvertently punch with the strength of a heavyweight, you may knock someone out and you don't want to knock out. Brown is zeroed in on the notion of trust. So this is all about power. All about the power must be prescribed. You have to use your power to solve problems, like produce energy and clean up the environment. But we will not use it to do one-off transactions with people who take advantage of them. Recognizing that can come back to do business again. In other words, create a relationship that isn't a relationship. Relationships have to be mutual. We are in business to generate wealth, but we have to do it today, tomorrow, and the next day, and the day after that, and the day after that. True North, trust, and the like. They are the mission impossible. Not really, of course. In their seminal book, Built to Last, Successful Habits of Visionary Companies, James Collins and Jerry Porras point out that great CEOs are less concerned with strategies, business models, particular products, or immediate financial payoffs than they are with building great institutions that serve all their constituencies over long periods of time. So in subsequent shows, we're going to be following up on this idea of the importance of trust in organizations, then as it is now. See you soon.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, Burnaby, BC.
Hello to you all, and welcome to Viewpoints on today's show. In Ontario, a long-forgotten 1954 time capsule